بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
With a caravan to cross the Sahara to Mali and Bilad al-Sultan, Ibn Battuta sets off again. Today, Tuareg guides and the Indigo Blue still make that camel trek from Gulamin to Morocco, near his departure point of Sial Massa, then prosperous, but now deserted. The crossing takes 63 days. Ibn Battuta did not count them, but he simply described the trip as long and arduous. It was not out of casual curiosity that Ibn Battuta went in this direction. Central West Africa was on the rise, undergoing its own remarkable blossoming. The upper valleys of Senegal and Niger rivers were fruitful. They easily provisioned the rich gold mines at Bambouk and Bure. Had the demand for gold from Dar al-Islam been all there was, the region and the kingdom of Mali would have maintained a prosperous but stagnant economy. But there was far greater demand for gold. The Christian lands of Europe were converting to stably priced but foreign gold from local but price volatile silver. The effect on Mali, which then produced 60% or more of the world's total supply of gold, was an economic boom. The new wealth could support stronger armies, whose conquests in turn enlarged the tax base to include more farmers and herders. The caravans of camels that carried the gold of Mali north to Morocco also carried the region's other exports, such as hides, nuts, ostrich and other feathers, ivory and salt. In the opposite direction went cotton, textiles, spices, finished jewelry, grain, dried fruit, horses for the Malian army, and the metals that Western Central Africa lacked, silver, copper and iron. One example alone demonstrated the extraordinary range of the Muslim commercial system. Qari shawls from the Maldives were used as money in Sudan and Mali, and gold from Mali turned up in the Maldives, 9,000 kilometers and an ocean away. The Mali-Morocco trade was dominated by Berber merchants who had settled in Mali and the savanna lands south of the gold fields. Thanks to their connections with these merchants, Muslim traders also arrived, settled amongst the locals, built mosques, and called the people to prayer. Muslim concepts of fair trade helped bring order to the boom times and won their practitioners respect that reflected well on their religion. As with other expansions of Islam, conversion brought the need for administration, for qadis, for ulama, and all the administrative infrastructure that was part of the network that had produced Ibn Battuta and thrived by his labors and those of his colleagues. This process is spectacularly illustrated by the example of Mali's most fabled king, Mansa Musa, who became a legend by distributing so much gold in Cairo en route to Hajj in 1324 that he depressed the market. The chronicler Al-Umari wrote, "He established the Friday observances, praise in the congregation, and the Muadhin's call. He brought jurists to his country and became a student of religious sciences." The next stage of his journey from Taghaza to Walata was some 800 kilometers, broken by only one oasis. The terrain was so barren and the chance of becoming lost was so great that a relief convoy system had evolved. Caravan leaders would hire local Musafa tribesmen to act as a takshif, a messenger who, for a high fee, would precede them and inform the merchants of Walata of the caravan's coming. Those merchants then equipped a convoy of water bearers to march 4 days' distance out to meet the incoming caravan. The takshif was paid only when the two groups met, and
"Sometimes the takshif perishes in this desert and the people of Walata know nothing of the caravan and its people, or most of them perish too."
Imagine the relieved sighs when the men of the caravan, traveling mostly at night because of the heat, saw the lights of the water convoy on the horizon. From Mali, he took the Niger River, which he mistook for the Nile, since it flows eastward through Mali before abruptly turning south into Nigeria. He wrote copiously about this region, especially its Arabic language and Islamic culture, and recounted stories about cannibal tribes in the south. Travel weariness sets in. His reception by locals is not as he anticipated, and he suffers from severe bouts of food poisoning. In January 1354, Ibn Battuta arrived back in Fez to an enthusiastic welcome from Sultan Abu Inan, who deemed Ibn Battuta's stories worth recording. He assigned the task to the scribe and poet Ibn Jose, who had been so impressed with Ibn Battuta when they met in Granada and who may indeed have expressed an enthusiasm for the job. Although we know Ibn Battuta's account today by its generic title of Rehla, its original title was more florid, in the court style of the day. translating as a gift to those who contemplate the wonders of cities and the marvels of traveling. Strictly defined, a rihla was a written account of a Hajj journey. We saw earlier how portions of Ibn Battuta's descriptions of Medina and Mecca closely paralleled or were copied directly from a rihla of Ibn Jubayr's pen a century earlier. Such unacknowledged copying, done with or without Ibn Battuta's knowledge, was not fair play by the standards of his time any more than our own. But perhaps Ibn Juzay thought that only one pair of eyes, the Sultan's, would ever read this rihla. Ironically, Ibn Battuta only came to be appreciated centuries after his death. His peers and contemporaries often flatly disbelieved him and said so. A more gracious comment came in the 15th century from Muhammad ibn Marzuq, a scholar who said, "I know of no person who journeyed to so many lands on his travels, and he was generous and well-doing." After that, little is heard about the rihla, although it circulated in Arabic, mostly at the Maghreb region, until European scholars rediscovered it a century and a half ago. It attracted the interest of historian Sir Hamilton Gibb, whose unabridged translation made the rihla widely available in English, beginning in 1958, and from whose definitive four-volume work much of our documentary is based on. Ibn Battuta died in 1369 at the age of 65. His death came 11 or 12 years after he finished dictating the rihla, a project that appears to have come to an end with the death of Ibn Juzay. We know nothing of the rest of Ibn Battuta's life, except that he served as a qadi in an unrecorded Moroccan town. As to his world, one of the greatest virtues of the rihla is that it is so voluminous that everyone who reads it finds facets to enjoy. Let us focus for a concluding moment on one largely unremarked but very important aspect of the work. Local markets. Here are the price of chickens. There, the markups for salt. And everywhere, the cash and barter prices for no end of eggs, cucumbers, yams, jewelry, household items, perfumes, carpets, and so on. To say nothing of the cash price for other cash. The rihla is our era's only available stroll through the supermarkets and banks of the early 14th century, the only source for the lingerie view of history that became so influential in the second half of the 20th century. Put these details together with his descriptions of transport and delivery infrastructure. Support them with his specifics on the number of funding of waqafs, madrasas, royal entourages, models of taxation, armies, shipbuilding, and the organizing of caravans. And there takes shape, before our eyes, an enormous canvas detailing the workings of an intricate, sophisticated, global pre-industrial economy. Our delight in his gift, as we contemplate the wonders of his travels, lives on. Join us in segment 17 in our journey of discovering another pioneering traveler. Who will it be?
أخي يا مقيما سامع